we can start for our late morning session up to lunch. Just like to say, we're very happy to have Johannes Bronckhorst here. I've been told already that I don't need to make any introduction for this man. I should just say he's a widely renowned philosopher who's been absolutely everywhere. That almost covers it, except he's currently in Lausanne and has written extensively on philosophy, on asceticism, on also scientific thinking, and on language in Indian philosophy across Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain sort of range of philosophies. Yeah, and speaking to us here today on ontological categories. Very happy to have him here to speak.
Thank you very much. Two initial remarks, one little correction. First, a very small thing. We have discovered why the loudspeaker doesn't work. It isn't a loudspeaker. It's a lamp.
Wrong category.
Second remark, more related to what I'm going to say today. I am not a philosopher. And that makes me a little bit an odd man out here. Not the only exception, but I do think that a majority of speakers is more philosophically trained and more philosophically oriented than I am. I like to think of myself as a historian of ideas, and that means that I may approach the same or very similar texts and data, but in a somewhat different way. I will tend to emphasize that every single thinker does so in a context, in a cultural context, and I will always be very worried to forget about the context and forget about the tradition and pull him out and argue with him on a philosophical level. Not that we can't do so. Don't take this as the fundamental criticism. It's just a difference of emphasis. I will tend to look at context, at tradition, and try to understand a thinker in terms of what was his background, what was his obligation towards his surroundings, and try to understand him in such terms. I'm also interested, as a historian, in how certain things, like the categories we talk about today, how they began. Now, I like to emphasize right from the beginning that this is not because I have a sickly obsession with origins, which has so rightly often been criticized in religious studies and other fields of investigation. No, I'm not obsessed with origins, but I think origins, beginnings, also have their place in studies of traditions. And since traditions have a tendency to continue what they, well, inherit, these earlier phases, and if accessible, these origins, have something to contribute, do deserve our attention. And that is how I will proceed today. I will, before I address the topic of this conference, stricto sensu, I will depict to you how I see the beginning and early history of Indian philosophy. That will create a background into which I can then explain or share with you certain thoughts about categories. So, bear with me. I will first say a few things about the beginnings of Indian systematic philosophy as I have come to see it over the years. I say systematic philosophy because we all know that philosophy all by itself is a term that everyone can use as he likes, so that there will be endless discussions about what is philosophy and what is not, into which I do not wish to enter. I talk about the beginnings of systematic philosophy, that means the development of systems of ideas, of coherent groups of ideas. And here, as I've come to think of it, this does not begin with the Upanishads. That is the standard beginning. In many of the manuals, for me, they contain nothing like systematic philosophy, and I will not say more about them. But nor will I put at the beginning the so-called Vedanta philosophy, which some purists will call Vedantism or something like that. That is a school of Brahmanical philosophy that bases itself, or claims to base itself, on the Upanishads. Let's be clear, that's not the same thing. There's a school of philosophy that claims that its contents are derived from the Upanishads. This is not the same as the Upanishads. This should be obvious to all. I just remind you once more of this. Well, the Vedanta philosophy, I'm not enough of a purist to say Vedantism, which doesn't come so easily off my tongue. The Vedanta philosophy, if you have looked at texts on the debates and the interactions between schools of Indian philosophy, is not the first classical Indian philosophy. In fact, in a certain sense, it is the last one. Until the middle of the first millennium, you don't find any Vedanta treatises. All that comes after the middle of the first millennium of the Common Era. That means centuries and centuries after other schools of thought, Vaisheshika, of course, Nyaya, Sankhya, and a number of Buddhist schools had been extremely productive for a very, very long time. So not only the Upanishads do not figure in my picture of the beginnings of Indian philosophy, but the Vedanta philosophy does not figure there either. As I have come to think of it, Indian systematic philosophy begins with a school of Buddhism. It begins with Buddhism, but not with the Buddhism as we know it from the early Pali texts or the early Sutra Pitaka in Pali or translated in some other languages. No, it begins in one school of Buddhism which is situated in the northwest of the subcontinent, the area which epigraphists and archaeologists like to refer to as Greater Gandhara. Gandhara is a region in what is now Pakistan, spills over, I think, just across the border of Afghanistan. And Gandhara is the center of a region which people like to refer to as Greater Gandhara. And there, in the last two centuries before the Common Era, an amazing activity took place, which led to what I consider the beginning of systematic philosophy in India. Now, let me try to point out what happened and what tradition this development was based on. We know that Buddhism arose not in the far northwest of the subcontinent, but rather in the eastern part of the Ganges Valley, in an area which I like to call Greater Magadha, but you don't have to follow me in this designation. Buddhism arose in the East, and probably because of favorable political developments, not so long after the death of its founder, namely the creation of the Mauryan Empire, spread far and wide in the Indian subcontinent. Went to the southeast, into Andhra Pradesh, went to the southwest, but also a very important Buddhist region arose in precisely Greater Gandhara, the far northwest. Now, all these Buddhists, they carried with them the fact that they were Buddhists, that in principle they followed the words of the Buddha. And the words of the Buddha had been preserved, more or less, in the sutras, the discourses that the Buddha supposedly held and that were memorized by monks. Of course, the rules of behavior, monkish behavior, the Vinaya, were also preserved. In fact, they were, for many Buddhists, more important than the discourses of the Buddha, because they said how to live as a good monk. So, and as you remember, the Buddhist tradition has three of those baskets: the basket of discourses, sutras; the basket of rules of behavior for monks and nuns, the Vinaya Pitaka; and a third one, the Abhidharma Pitaka, the basket of scholastics, I think we may call it. But it is this third basket that is, I think, very important in the developments I'm going to sketch, because in this third basket, people did not just record, remember, recite the words of the Buddha as a story or as rules of behavior, but essentially in the form of lists. Lists of crucial concepts that were considered to be to embody the central parts of the teaching of the Buddha. And initially these lists, the elements of those lists did not had various names, but soon the common name that came to be attached to all of them is Dharma. And in these lists of Dharmas that were preserved, you find all kinds of elements, but often of a more or less psychological nature. This because the teaching of the Buddha had a lot to do with, well, psychological processes, ways of getting to the aim of liberation from rebirth and karmic retribution. But we concentrate for the time being on the lists. These lists, there were a number of shorter lists they sometimes put together, or in the end, rather long lists, so-called matrikas, were constituted, and preserving those lists and trying to understand those lists was considered, or came to be considered, an important activity for the Buddhist community. So all the Buddhists, wherever they went, they carried with them these lists of dharmas. Now, that in itself is interesting, but does not yet constitute the beginning of systematic philosophy. Things changed in the northwest, in Greater Gandhara. There, for reasons that can be discussed, but that remain relatively obscure, Buddhist thinkers started using those lists of dharmas to develop a scheme of reality. They use them as elements of a vision of how the world is constituted, and which aim to be a coherent vision, and therefore deserves the name of the first attempt at systematic philosophy. Now, one of the things that these thinkers of Northwest India decided is, perhaps not from one day to the next, we don't know the details. We have to work with very scarce source material, of which we have to make the best. But nonetheless, The outcome is very clear. At some point, they had decided that these lists of dharmas were not just kind of, what you call that in English, de mémoire, ways of trying to remember what the Buddha had taught. No, these lists represented more. They were lists of the elements of existence, as people have called them. These dharmas got an ontological dimension. They were things, so to say, in some sense of existing thing. And so the school ended up with a long list of fundamental elements of existence. Let me clarify by saying that not all these elements were of a psychological nature. Thank goodness there were also elements that, color or form and all that, that were more directly related to the material world. And people started in that part, in that particular Buddhist movement, which probably called itself at that time already Sarvastivada, but I wouldn't swear on that, because but that's the name that comes to be associated with these development, the school called Sarvastivada. You may have heard of that before. Now, in Sarvastivada, the Buddhist thinkers now had a list of the elements of existence. They claimed further that because their list of dharmas was complete, they had a full list of all the elements of existence. That means whatever there is in this world is constituted of dharmas. They added a little detail, which also became important. Dharmas, they do not last. Dharmas are momentary. So everything that exists is constituted of dharmas that are atomic in some sense, ultimate constituents of what there is, and momentary. So the world we know is, well, if we manage to look below the surface, we'll see this busy world of dharmas that each last one moment is succeeded by another one, and they're all very small, and they together join up to make larger entities, and so on. Now, this already is, in a way, exciting enough. It's an idea of how the world we know is constituted. But these thinkers went one step further. And they said, yes, the ultimate components of reality are the dharmas. But then they made a next step and said, composites do not exist. Now, perhaps you know this from this lovely text called the Milinda Panya, where it is put in a most accessible form. The king, it's King Menander, it's a Greek king, it's called a Greek king. He comes and talk to a Buddhist monk, and they get into a discussion about whether the king had come on foot or in a chariot. And the king said, of course, I've come in a chariot. And then Nagasena, he fires a lot of questions at the king. He says, are the reins the chariot? Is this part the wheel of the chariot? And enumerates all the parts of the chariot. And somehow the king, by the end of the discussion, is convinced that there is no such thing as a chariot. And now, this is a theme that is not only acute subject of a story in the Milinda Panya, it is a central theme of certain developments of Sarvastivada Buddhism. They said all composite objects do not strictly exist, only ultimate constituents exist. Because if you stick to the chariot, it's easy to see that if the story about a chariot, that the wheel is not a chariot, the reins are not a chariot, could be repeated with regard to the wheel or with regard to the rein. And in the end, we would come end up with the ultimate constituents of all there is, and that, of course, for these Buddhists, were the dharmas. So, with this second step, these Buddhists had added an even more remarkable feature to their philosophy. They did not only say that the world we know, if you look below the surface, you only find teeming dharmas that succeed and interact with each other. No, they had came now to the... They added to this that the objects we think we see, the chairs, the persons, whatever we see, do not really exist at all, because they are composite. Only the dharmas exist. Now, ontologically, this becomes quite interesting, of course. For these Buddhists, the world of our daily experience has no ultimate reality. What really exists are only these dharmas, only these ultimate elements of existence, and nothing else. Now, of course, as interesting as it is, this philosophy, this ontology, it raises obvious questions, many questions, in fact, and in the old Abhidharma texts, they are quite voluminous, and they try to answer every conceivable question you might raise, and they get into a technicality and a technicity which is sometimes discouraging for the scholar. But one particular issue, of course, is not so technical, is actually quite straightforward. Namely, if the king says, "I didn't come by chariot, what's going on here? What happened to my chariot?" And the answer that Nagasena gives is, there is no chariot. Chariot is just a word, just an expression. Now, here we are, other texts, they amplify this, and they show that for these thinkers, the world of our experience is the product of language, of words. Right? The chairs, the persons, everything I see, the chariots, the bus I may take to go somewhere, the roomy house where I stay overnight, they have no ultimate existence, but I think they are there because we have words for them. And we see that in this ontology, which the Sarvastivadins developed, language came to play a really crucial role, not because ultimate reality has anything to do with language, but because the non-ultimate reality, that means the reality we believe in that doesn't really exist, is created by the words of language. Now, this is what happened in the northwestern parts of the Indian subcontinent, probably in the last two centuries before the Common Era. I think that already the Brahmanical author Patanjali is aware of the main developments that took place in Sarvastivada. Of course, he never says that. He wants nothing to do with Buddhists. He is a Brahmanical grammatical author. But I think there are enough passages in his big Mahabhashya to support the claim that he was aware of these developments, and therefore, because his date is quite precise, relatively precisely known, say second half of the second century before the Common Era, we may assume that these Buddhists had started developing their system in the years or decades preceding him, so in perhaps the first half of the second century before the Common Era. This, as I see it, was the first attempt at systematic philosophy in the Indian subcontinent. Why it took place, wonderful question, needs attention. I'm not going to bore you with it. I move on, because Sarvastivada did not remain for very long the only systematic philosophy in the Indian subcontinent. Brahmanism started creating ontologies of its own. And, of course, as you know, the two most well-known Brahmanical ontologies are Sankhya and Vaisheshika. I'm not going to say anything about Sankhya. I am going to say a few things about Vaisheshika, because I think it is visible that Vaisheshika, even though it has absolutely nothing to do with Buddhism, it is a Brahmanical school which would disagree with anything that any Buddhist would ever say, in its structure shows the influence of Buddhism. And that means Vaisheshika, and I'm going to show you how that works, created an ontology which can be seen as a series of answers to essentially the same questions that the Buddhists had asked, only with this difference that they would try to give an opposite answer, which is as different as possible from what the Buddhists had said. Now, in a certain way, Vaisheshika ontology, in its central elements, is like a mirror image of Sarvastivada ontology. It differs where it can, but through the differences, it shows that it asked exactly the same questions and came up with an answer which was the very opposite of that. And let me come back to the three points which I mentioned about Sarvastivada. Sarvastivada ontology, in its list of dharmas, had a complete and exhaustive list of all there is. Had the numbers vary a bit from school to school, maybe 75 in some versions, maybe a bit more, maybe up to 100. But nonetheless, each particular Buddhist philosopher would think that his list 75 dharmas, or 80, whatever it was an exhaustive list of all there is. I remind you that dharmas are the constituents of macroscopic objects, but macroscopic objects for these Buddhists do not exist. So there are only these dharmas, and the Sarvastivadins had a complete list of all there is, an ontological list. Sarvastivada searches for exactly the same thing. It searches for a complete enumeration of all there is. Not approximate, full. A full list of all there is. And it creates one. It creates one. I will not say more about it, because I come back to it when we talk about categories in a minute. But like the Sarvastivadins, the Vaisheshikas create an exhaustive list of all there is. Now remember that the Sarvastivadin said composite objects do not exist. There is no such thing as a chair or a chariot. There is only a word. In reality, these things do not exist. Vaisheshika takes on the problem and gives the opposite answer. It says their ultimate constituents, which they think of as atoms normally, there are composite objects, and both exist. That means the chariot is one thing, its wheel is another. In fact, if you study Vaisheshika a bit further, you'll see that it got them into interesting questions, like if you have a pot. A pot obviously consists of two half pots. It may not have been made that way, that's not the issue. A whole pot is a combination of two half pots. Vaisheshika ontology would say these things constitute three different objects, three different things. And they will try to draw the consequences of that particular vision, which sometimes led them into rather complicated discussions and postulates. But nonetheless, they did exactly the opposite of what the Sarvastivadins had done. The Sarvastivadins had said, there are no composite objects, there are only composants, ultimate components. Vaisheshika says there are composite objects, there are ultimate components and intermediate components, and they all exist next to each other, so to say. And the third point, which I mentioned with regard to Sarvastivada, was that they called in language in order to account for the fact that we think we live in a world of chariots and chairs and persons and so on. Language was there to make up for our fundamentally incorrect impression of the world we live in. Now, Vaisheshika addressed the same question and came up with the opposite answer. It said, it's true, there is a very close relationship between language, the words of language, and things, but language doesn't cheat us. Language is a reliable guide to find out about reality. Language is an instrument to find out not about an imaginary world, an imposed reality, but about real reality. Now, this last point may justify a little elaboration, because language in the Brahmanical tradition was not just something. And here, if we discuss as philosophers, we may lose sometimes sight of some obvious facts. In the Brahmanical tradition, Sanskrit is not a language. It is the language. There is only one language, and all the rest is corruptions. And if we forget that, if we talk as if there is Sanskrit, there is English, and so on, I think we risk missing some really central points that are self-evident for the Brahmanical thinker, but may not be self-evident for us in the modern world, because we have given up such notions. Okay, this is all I'm going to say as in my little sketch about how I see a small part of the early history, early development of Indian ontology. And I'm now going to address the topic of today's conference, namely the categories. I had understood somehow that I would be one of the first speakers, so anticipating that every single speaker would give the list of the Chinese encyclopedia, I thought, being one of the first, I can afford to give it. But Professor Flood, he has, used it already in his preliminary talk, so I will not repeat the whole list, but I will nonetheless refer to it to try to draw some lessons from it. So I guess everyone was here to hear the list, and you don't need all the details. It is probably not necessary to remind you that this classification, I talk about the classification in the Chinese encyclopedia, the Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge, that this classification does not occur in any real Chinese encyclopedia, that it is the product of the imagination of Mr. Borges, who used it in one of his essays. This hardly matters for our present purposes, for it reminds us that the usefulness of categories depends on what we expect from them. there are less exotic categorizations that are useful in one context, but less so in another. In certain situations, it makes perfect sense to distinguish between animals that live in the sea and those that live on land. Whales and dolphins will in this way be categorized as animals that live in the sea, like fish. There's nothing wrong with this categorization, except that biologists will prefer another one, in which whales and dolphins are mammals, which therefore have to be categorized rather with many terrestrial animals. Biologists prefer this second categorization because they believe it provides information that reaches below the surface. The biological categorization tells us something about the place of whales and dolphins in the animal kingdom, about their ancestry and relatedness to other animals. These reflections suggest that some categorizations seem more real, on inverted commas, to us in some sense than others. We think that the categorization of animals in the Chinese encyclopedia is rather useless because it does not tell us anything more profound about these animals and their relationships to each other than the mere fact of being listed here. The example from biology further supports the idea that some categorizations are indeed more real, for the time being in inverted commas, than others, that they somehow reveal an aspect of the world that might otherwise escape us. The categorization of whales and dolphins as mammals is, as a matter of fact, the result of biological research. Before this research had been done, they would no doubt have been wrongly categorized. Thanks to the knowledge acquired in biology, they could henceforth be categorized more satisfactorily and presumably more correctly, still for the time being in inverted commas. Now, if I were a philosopher speaking about a philosophy of science, and you know already I'm not a philosopher, I might conclude from all this that categorizations are risky, that they may have to be modified in the light of new knowledge, that rigid categorizations should be avoided before all the data are in, etc. However, I do not speak about a philosophy of science, nor am I a philosopher. I'm an Indologist trying to understand how and why categories were used in early Indian philosophy. Since I wish to speak about the conscious and explicit use of categories, the only forms of Indian philosophy that have to be considered are its systematic manifestations. I talked to you already about this, and I explained that, in my view, the first attempt at creating a coherent system of thought in the Indian subcontinent is associated with the Sarvastivadins, and that it clearly had its ontological categories. However, the Sarvastivadins did not have to create their ontological categories. They were Buddhists and were therefore more or less bound to the categories that were part of this tradition. Now, what early Buddhist systematizers used to categorize their lists of dharmas were lists they found in their ancient tradition. They used preferably the list of five skandhas. Now, if you don't know what the skandhas are, I'm not going to explain it because I'm not sure if I know. But they are always presented in the early Buddhist texts as the constituents of a human being. A human being consists of five skandhas. Sometimes they used other lists that came up in the old texts, like the 12 so-called ayatanas, the realms, this list of the eye and the eye object, the ear and the ear object and so on. So they came to 12. Sometimes they added something more and they came to 18 dhatus. In any case, they found lists in the old text, which they then used to try to categorize their dharmas. So the list of skandhas and these other lists had always been there and had been accepted by the Buddha, or at least that's what I believed. So these lists had to be valid and validated. The ontological attempts of the Sarvastivadins had to find a place for them, or rather, the ontological elements which they were going to use had to be categorized in a manner that somehow had come down through tradition. Now, I don't need to remind you that the ontological attempts of the Sarvastivadins were elaborations of their decision to take the lists of dharmas that had been collected by Buddhists as lists of elements of existence. That's what I explained to you earlier. Human beings and everything else are in the end no more than accumulations of dharmas. Strictly speaking, only those dharmas exist. Accumulations of dharmas have no separate existence. This is just a short reformulation of what I said earlier. The five skandhas had always been presented as the five constituents of human beings. It is easy to see that a joint observation that human beings are accumulations of dharmas and that human beings consist of the five dharma skandhas led to the conclusion that each dharma belongs to one skandha, and that the five skandhas are therefore a way to categorize the dharmas. This, as we know, is what these Buddhists did. A traditional list of dharmas was categorized with the help of what was thought of as a traditional list of categories. Now, none of this is very remarkable from the point of view of our interest in categorization. What is remarkable is that these same Buddhists became dissatisfied with their traditional categories and created another list of five. To use the terminology of Frau Wallner, who drew attention to this development, a newly invented list of five vastus, a different term is used, a pancha vastuka, replaced the traditional pancha skandhaka, the list of five skandhas. The five vastus of the pancha vastuka, well, I will not enumerate Sanskrit words, some of you may lose the thread, but they have names. The advantage for the Sarvastivadins of the pancha vastuka, the list of five vastus, over the pancha skandhaka is undeniable. The new categorization left place for a number of dharmas which were crucial in the ontology elaborated by these Buddhists. Two of the five categories of the pancha vastuka had nothing corresponding to them in the pancha skandhaka. I hope you follow. The new list of five vastus had two vastus, two categories, which had nothing corresponding to them in the list of five skandhas. And yet, these new categories contained a number of dharmas that were essential to Sarvastivada ontology. From the point of view of the Sarvastivadins, the Panchavastuka was no doubt more real, in some sense, than the Pancha Skandhaka, closer to reality as they conceived of it. Unfortunately, it was also a new invention, one difficult to justify on the basis of the words traditionally attributed to the Buddha. And here, I repeat, if we study a tradition, we must never forget the tradition. In a tradition, you cannot just, because you're so clever, come up with something new. No one will accept it if it is not justified by the tradition. This is what happened to this new, much improved categorization of the Sarvastivadins. They could not justify it by citing words of the Buddha. So Frau Wallner, the name of this historian of Indian philosophy, he regards, and I cite him here, the creation of the Panchavastuka as the most important step on the way from Buddhist dogmatics to a philosophical system. He may be right, but the fate of the Panchavastuka illustrates that a Buddhist philosophical system is never just a philosophical system. It is also a religious tradition. The Buddhist tradition did not feel comfortable with this new invention and preferred the Buddha's word to the inventions of his followers. This explains that even within Sarvastivada and in spite of a promising beginning, the Panchavastuka came to play a secondary role in subsequent treatises, including Vasubandhu's Abhidharmakosha and Abhidharmakosha Bhashya. Obviously, the Buddhist philosophers were all in favor of categories on condition that the Buddha had pronounced these categories. There are good reasons to believe, and I discussed that earlier, that the Brahmanical ontology that goes by the name Vaisheshika was created in response to Sarvastivada ontology. Both can, to a surprising extent, be presented as answers to the same questions. I've tried to illustrate this earlier. The questions were the same. The answer had to be different, of course. Whatever the details of the development that led to the formulation of Vaisheshika ontology, its makers had a much freer hand than the Buddhists. They did not believe that this ontology was already present in their textual tradition, primarily the Veda. Vaisheshika is very intriguing because it does, in its early stages, not appear to continue any tradition. I think it is a newly created system of philosophy, which is, after all I've said about traditions, of course, very interesting. Now, the Vaisheshikas did not think either that in the Veda there would be a complete enumeration of all that exists. They were free to create an ontology ex nihilo, so to say. However, they had to respect one important restriction. Brahmanism is a tradition of the word. The word, that is the Sanskrit language, is eternal and finds its purest expression in the Veda. The Sanskrit language is not just any language. In an important sense, it is the only language of which all other languages are no more than corruptions. This one and eternal language is also close to reality. Indeed, the idea that the world is created at the beginning of each cosmic cycle in accordance with the words of the Veda is a recurring mythological theme. The Vaisheshika philosophers took the close connection between words and things for granted. The argument that this or that thing, whatever it be, must exist because there is a word for it recurs several times in their writings, a couple of times in the Prashastapada Bhashya. As a first approximation, one can therefore say that the list of all Sanskrit words is, as a first approximation, a good list of all existing things. This approximation has to be refined, to be sure, but we can easily see that these Brahmanical thinkers did not need a list of dharmas which had provided their Buddhist confreres with an enumeration of all that exists. Their sacred and eternal language provided them with much of what they needed. We saw that the Buddhists categorized their dharmas with the help of other traditional lists, which they looked upon as lists of categories. The list of the five skandhas was considered particularly useful, but we have also seen that the Sarvastivadins were confronted with its shortcomings and tried to improve upon it. The Vaisheshika thinkers had no traditional lists to choose from and could only draw inspiration from the Sanskrit language. Does the Sanskrit language provide ontological categories? It does, at least in the understanding of the early and highly respected grammarian Patanjali. I mentioned him already, who wrote his great commentary, his Mahabhashya, in soon after the year 150 before the Common Era. Patanjali distinguishes three kinds of words, which he calls jati shabda, guna shabda, and kriya shabda, respectively. These correspond to our nouns, adjectives, and verbs, and designate dravya, substance, qualities, guna, and actions, kriya, respectively. The Vaisheshikas took this to heart and divided all, or almost all, existing things into three categories: substances, qualities, and actions. For reasons internal to their system, they added a few more categories, so to arrive at 6, 7, sometimes even 10 or more, but their fundamental categorization consisted of these three. The other ones were mere add-ons to deal with theoretical questions that came up. Why did they choose these categories, not any others? I do not think that the Vaisheshika texts ever raised this issue in its generality, and it is easy to understand why. A difference of opinion about some of the added categories might be possible, and did indeed occur. The core of their system of categorization, on the other hand, was not open to debate because it was a given. It was obvious to a Vaisheshika that in a situation described by the words the blue bird at the yellow butterfly, that there are two substances here, the bird and the butterfly, two qualities, blue and yellow, and one action, eating. This, he might have argued, was not a categorization imposed upon reality, but a given. In other words, the Vaisheshika categories, or at any rate the ones they all agreed about, constitute a natural categorization. It tells us something about reality, just as the categorization of whales as mammals tells us something about reality, and is not an option that could fruitfully be replaced by another categorization. If, armed with this information about categorization in early Indian ontologies, we turn to the theme of this conference, namely the idea of a category in Indian philosophy, we have to ask ourselves what ideas the Sarvastivadins and the Vaisheshikas had of the categories they imposed upon the world. Of the categorizations considered so far, the Pancha Vastuka, the innovation of the Sarvastivadins in 5 vastus, the Pancha Vastuka might be expected to be the most interesting, for it was admittedly a human creation invented to fit the ontological data accepted by its creators. The other categorizations considered, the Panchaskandhaka and the fundamental categorization of Vaisheshika, are less promising, for they were not believed to have had any creators in the ordinary sense. The Panchaskandhakas, the 5 skandhas, owed its acceptance to the fact that the Buddha was believed to have pronounced it. And the fundamental categories of Vaisheshika were looked upon as a given that needed no creator. Without a creator or inventor, they needed no justification either. What about the Panchavastuka, the innovation of Sarvastivada? This categorization had been invented. Why? We have seen that the Panchavastuka did not come to occupy the place which its qualities should have earned for it. We have also seen that the reason why it had to content itself with a secondary position in Buddhist ontological discussions was the very fact that ordinary humans had invented it. It is one of the tragedies of the history of Indian philosophy that these ordinary humans, in inverted commas, who had created a new categorization, were not given the respect by their successors, which in our opinion they deserved. No discussion arose about the need to invent a new categorization if the traditional one is not satisfactory. No questions were asked about the place and justification of categories in general. This is a pity, for it makes it all but impossible to answer the question of our conference as far as ontology in early Indian philosophy is concerned. Now, so far in my paper, but I won't yet stop. I see I still have some time. I want to add a few words about a topic that has come up a bit before and that may come up in discussion. Why did they bother? Why did they make the effort? And I think that is always a very good question. It's one of my favorite questions. That doesn't mean that one can always find an answer, but if we forget it, we risk to float off on clouds in the sky. Why did they do it? What would they gain? And I think in the case of Vaisheshika ontology and other Brahmanical ontologies, here I think the situation, there is the link that was evoked by one of you earlier with soteriology. But what is that link? Why should my attempt to create an ontology help me to be freed? Freed from what? Rebirth and karmic retribution. That's the eternal background theme, not heaven or some bliss. Forget about that. Rebirth, karmic retribution. Why should being a philosopher help me get there? And yet that is a theme that is so often repeated in our texts. Now, in the case of most of the Brahmanical philosophies, I think this link is very clear. Rebirth, karmic retribution, means that my activity leads to, well, retribution. I come back. And in the Indian situation, people, at least the religiously inclined people, do not want to come back. How do you avoid getting the consequences of your deeds? Well, it doesn't help to be good. If you're good, you get a good rebirth. It doesn't help to be bad. If you're bad, you get a bad rebirth. So you have to find something else. And the most obvious answer, obviously, is that if what I do leads to consequences, I should stop doing something. Now, I think in a very literal sense, we find that in early Jainism. It's a bit more complicated. If you're questioning me, I'll say more. But I will skip that. In Jainism, we see it. If you've been to Shravana Balgola and you've seen the ascetic standing there and the plants growing around his leg, and we see that he has been standing there for a really, really long time. And we read the ancient text, we see that abstention from activity was a real concern. And of course, the link with karmic retribution is as obvious as anything can be. But this is not the thought that inspired many of the Brahmanical philosophies. I talk about Vaisheshika, Sankhya, in a certain way, Vedanta. The easier way, rather than standing for a long time still, is to realize that your real self, your innermost self, by its very nature, never acts at all. This is a recurring theme, comes again all over in Sanskrit literature, and it's obviously why. They may add something, there may be some bliss, or there may be this, there may be that. That's secondary. The main thing is, my real self doesn't act. And because once I realize that my real self doesn't act, then I also realize that this whole cycle of karmic retribution was a colossal mistake. Because only my body acted, only my mind acted, but me, properly speaking, didn't act. And now, this is therefore a theme that comes back in the major Brahmanical philosophies. Bhartrihari is an exception, according to me. But and we also find it in Vaisheshika. There's a big ontology in which there is one substance called the self, and we know the self is omnipresent, the self doesn't act, the self may have some qualities pasted onto it, but if you go through the right procedure, the qualities will get off, and in the end, you will be liberated because a non-acting self does not undergo karmic retribution. Vaisheshika is interesting also because one of the qualities pasted onto the self in Vaisheshika is buddhi, that means consciousness. And the result is that in Vaisheshika, liberation is a state without consciousness. That's a good reminder that we shouldn't insist on all these other things like bliss or whatever else, or consciousness, that others, some want to add to this fundamental feature, namely inactivity of the self. Now, so about the two schools I talked about today, in the case of Vaisheshika, this is fairly straightforward, fairly obvious. Behind this beautiful structure, there is a self that doesn't act. In Buddhism, it is much less clear. In fact, Buddhism started more clearly than Vaisheshika as a way to teach the way to liberation. But by the time our Sarvastivadins started developing their systematization, it seems that they had forgotten quite a bit about this. In their books, in their canonical books, the ones that date perhaps partly from before the beginning of the Common Era, we find lots of dharmas, lots of discussions, and so on, but we do not find much about meditation or why this should be of much help to reach liberation. In fact, that is a theme that comes back a few centuries later in one author of the school, Dharmasreshtin, who wrote a book, the Abhidharma Hridaya, and there he uses this material and this thought and this systematization to put them in such a way to try to make plausible that knowledge of all the dharmas, and that means all that what that implies, and that in his case means understanding Sarvastivada philosophy, is a complete way of understanding the Four Noble Truths, which he sneakily has got back into the system. And the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths is an old theme in the Buddhist tradition. Once you know them, you are ready for nirvana. So these are just some supplementary remarks. I think I stop now, and perhaps we have some discussion.